And our sermon text this day is Romans 9, 9 to 13. For this is what the promise said: about this time next year, I will return, and Sarah shall have a son. And not only so, but also when Rebekah had conceived children by one man, our forefather Isaac, though they were not yet born and had done nothing either good or bad, in order that God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of his call, she was told, "The older will serve the younger, as it is written, 'Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated.'" Absolute election is our title today, as we make our way through a profound chapter of God's Word, Romans chapter 9. What does it mean to be chosen by an absolute sovereign for anything? As we saw in our last Wednesday night Bible study, Muhammad, in his later career, had as many as 20 wives, sanctioned by Allah, too. Many women put themselves forward, though he couldn't get a date at the soda shop before becoming an apostle of Allah. But only a few were chosen, elected to be brides of his harem. Those elect included a 7-year-old daughter of an early follower, the beautiful wife of his son, and another beautiful wife of one of his lieutenants. Now, all biographers acknowledge that Muhammad was utterly sovereign. Whatever his moral constitution, right, breaking just about all the rules of consanguinity in the Holiness Code of Leviticus. Sovereigns. What does it mean to be chosen by an absolute sovereign? Louis XIV, King of France, at the apex of France's glory in the late 17th, early 18th century. Louis XIV, also known as the Sun King, is headquarters at the Palace of Versailles. I've been there twice. Debbie and I went there ourselves in our marriage. Louis XIV had established a daily court ritual in which it became a high honor for nobles to participate, nobles of France to participate. Dukes, counts, dauphins vied with each other to be chosen to put on his morning robe, serve him his morning tea, hold his parasol on his afternoon stroll, and then help him with his nighttime PJs and cocoa. Cocoa had just been discovered in the New World, so it was a big thing. One's reputation and standing in all of France could be immeasurably enhanced by being chosen to empty his chamber pots. In ancient Babylon, too, it was a custom for a commoner to be chosen, to be elected to serve as king of all Babylon for a period of time, when a solar eclipse might occur. Solar eclipse is coming to our region in August, isn't it? It was a kind of wow moment for the commoner to suddenly be elevated from weeding fields in the hot sun to being pampered in the palace of the king for 2 to 3 weeks. But what he didn't know is that a solar eclipse was an evil omen for the king. The commoner was there to take the brunt of misfortune if it were to fall during the solar eclipse. And then, when the time of the eclipse had passed and danger was no longer threatened, he was summarily executed and the rightful king reinstated. Behold what it means to be chosen, elect by a human sovereign. Does that translate then to the living God of creation? When we talk about election, when we talk about being chosen by God, can we extrapolate to the character of God the character of human gods? Unfortunately, when we consider the doctrine of election, as we are here in chapter 9, that God, in the counsel of his own will and not the will of man, chose whom he will to save, and whom he will to damn, we put God in the same category as the fickle and capricious sovereigns we know from human experience, don't we, so often. But this is so wrong. We need to wean ourselves of thinking of God's choosing, God's election, in the same category as man's election. Job said, "For he is not a man as I am, that I might answer him that we should come to trial together. For my thoughts are not your thoughts," Isaiah says, "neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Isaiah said, "I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up," communicating to us his exaltation, his transcendence. That is, he is not like you and I. So, when we ponder God's choice and counsel in choosing, we must not make the all too common error of, "Well, since man does it this way, then God must do it this way also." That God indeed chooses, the transcendent God of the universe, the righteous, holy, and wise God of the universe chooses wisely and in holy, righteous will. That's the implicit premise for the whole of Romans chapter 9. God's choice of those whom he saves is not premised according to criteria we sanction, but rather that according to the counsel of his own will. And here is the rub for the bulk of mankind, quite frankly, including much of Armenian America. Well, what do we mean by an utterly sovereign God? What do we mean by absolute election? Let's look at our text here today. First of all, verse 9. Absolute election, the utter sovereignty of God in election, is observed in the power of God's promise. The power of God's promise. Piggybacking on what we looked at last week. As we saw last week, an integral part of covenant is promise. You remember our definition for promise, very important. A covenant obligation is a promise, the performance of which is sworn in blood by the signatory, in this case, God the Father. In our case, the promise to Abraham through Sarah is that the son of the covenant will be born to a barren woman. This covenant obligation must be performed by a signatory powerful enough to make it happen, that is, to make a barren woman fertile. What a creative act is required in that case, isn't it? A creative act is utterly required. And this is a creative act, the likes of which no man can reproduce. No man can reproduce this creative act. But that doesn't stop him trying, does it? I heard one Armenian fellow with whom I was talking who didn't like this passage and its implications, and he quipped, "Well, we can overcome a lot of infertility these days because of what we know in science, right? By the grace of God, yes, of course. But this does not blunt God's sovereign hand in choosing an otherwise barren Sarah in whom to creatively bring forth a chosen son, Isaac, that he must sovereignly accomplish." And as we observed last week, once more again, if only the signatory can fulfill that promise, then it is his sovereign choice as to who will be counted, reckoned as his children. Isaac is the first, the son of promise. It is entirely an act of grace on the part of the signatory, the one making the promise, an obligation in blood. It was God's purpose of election, then, to choose the one individual Isaac as the initial offspring through whom the subsequent offspring of election would come, not according to the flesh, that is man's way of thinking, man's way of acting and deciding, but rather according to the promise, that is God's sovereign will. But this is not all. Let's look to verse 10. Absolute election. Absolute election. There's no wiggle room here. Keep looking for a way. There's no way around God's absolute election, his utter sovereignty. Point number two. inside flap of your bulletin, you'll find an outline here that we're following. Absolute election, the utter sovereignty of God in election, is observed in the miracle of Jacob and Esau's conception in verse 10. The utter sovereignty of God in election is observed in the miracle of Jacob and Esau's conception. Absolute election, the utter sovereignty of God. Sounds a little fishy, doesn't it? Sounds un-American somehow. But America was populated by Calvinists, my friends. Paul now brings forth, verse 10, an even clearer, more convincing example. That's the sense of, and not only so, upon which every student of the Bible could agree, that of Jacob and Esau. That of Jacob and Esau. Now, Calvin says that his Arminian opponent during his day, in Calvin's Calvinism, there's a great book out there called Calvin's Calvinism, in which he dialogues with an Arminian named Pigius. An Arminian, what is an Arminian? For those of you that don't know, perhaps we should define what an Arminian is. It's not some guy living off in Middle Asia somewhere. That's Armenia. An Arminian is an advocate of the free will point of view. That is, that man makes his own choice to be saved in Christ in the power of his own free will, free from the undue influence of God upon that will. Named after James Arminius, late 16th, early 17th century, being the most notable exponent of it, whose name has become attached to the view, Arminianism. Calvin says that his opponent finds this passage a labyrinth of difficulties and a complex of obscurities. Does it seem that way to you? Is this passage a labyrinth of difficulties and a complex of obscurities? Calvin goes on to say, thus he finds it precisely because of the clarity of Paul's thought and the forthrightness of his language in contradicting his opinion. That's why he finds it a labyrinth of difficulties and complex of obscurities. He goes on to say, Pigius must find it this way in order to find a way out of the absolute election of God in the salvation of man. The labyrinth of difficulties and complex of obscurities is thus, in truth, his resulting exposition of this portion of Scripture. The absolute election of God. The absolute election of God should create a bit of awe in your breast as you ponder the kind of God that we are dealing with. The absolute election of God is exactly where Paul is going in his argument. He's doing it with clarity and forthrightness. The case of Jacob and Esau is a sterling one, too. For at every turn in their career, God favored Jacob, whether in the matter of his birthright, which he stole, the blessing which he stole, prospering even under the oppressive hand of his uncle Laban, and then finding that Abraham's promise would be his at Bethel. Remember his encounter with God at Bethel? God promised him, your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Reiterating the promise to Abraham, right? He goes on to tell Jacob, behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. The covenant promise. The covenant promise to Jacob, the nature of which we've belabored, right? The nature of promise is his, is Jacob's, in a like manner reprised in Rebekah as it had been in Sarah. Rebekah was barren until God opened her womb to twins. which provides a perfect opportunity for God to demonstrate his electing purpose, doesn't it? And he does. Martin Luther, in his book, Bondage of the Will, says this about Erasmus. He says, Erasmus might have argued that God chose Isaac because he was the natural son over Ishmael, son of his handmaid, and not in the secret purpose of election. But this cannot be so with Jacob and Esau, brothers of the same womb, Luther says. Luther, in his Bondage of the Will, was responding to Erasmus's book, Freedom of the Will. Luther also said, Erasmus has yet to bring forth a passage that expressly declares free will as this does God's electing will. And he's right. I've had an open invitation. Bring me your verses on free will. And indeed, we will look at them. I had a hiking buddy who did precisely that, took up that challenge, went from Genesis to Revelation, and say, oh, you know, you're right, Pastor. I'm reading into that as free will, aren't I? Yes. Boom, 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 all the way he went through. And he was a Calvinist by the end of the summer. We did a lot of hiking, too. Well, indeed, at birth, Esau came first and thus was considered to be the firstborn and entitled to all the rights of primogeniture. What is the right of primogeniture? He is the first in line, the first generated, and so he's entitled to the blessings traditional in this culture. That is the birthright. He has the greater portion of the father's inheritance and the blessing, that is the laying on of hands by the father for his son's blessing by God for children and prosperity. The right of primogeniture. But what no one counted upon was the foreshadowing of God's elect purpose in his brother's grasping at Esau's heel, the one that was in the womb yet, as indeed, can you picture it, with Esau coming out of the womb and the midwife, wait a minute, somebody's holding on, right? The brother holding on to Esau's heel as he came out of the womb, being therefore named Jacob, which is Hebrew for grasping. Esau, Hebrew for red, because he was indeed red. And red and red hair and so forth would characterize him for the rest of his life. Jacob and Esau. Well, what does this tell us then about God's electing purpose, the heel grasper? Let's look to verse 11. Because it tells us indeed about absolute election, the utter sovereignty of God. No wiggle room here. The utter sovereignty of God in election is observed in the absence of one's merit as a ground for choice. The utter sovereignty of God in election is observed in the absence of one's merits as a ground for choice. Now in verse 11, Paul launches into a comparatively lengthy digression in order to unpack the ground for God's favor of one over the other. What is the ground of God's favor one over the other? Why does he choose Jacob then? What's the grounds for his choice? He begins with a concessive clause. Although the circumstance that is qualified is the ground of the personal merit of the respective sons, right? The circumstance that is qualified in this digression as he begins, although that circumstance is the ground of the personal merit of the respective sons, and there was none, right? There was no personal merit as the basis for the choice God makes Jacob over Esau. No personal merit whatsoever. How could there be? They were not yet born and had done nothing good or bad, Paul says. I had difficulty with this in my salad days in the Christian faith. Salad days? That's the early course, isn't it? Right? The early course in the meal of life. Part of the reason Arminian free will choice in salvation is so natural, isn't it? So human. Is that for God not to choose according to merit and demerit is just so counterintuitive, so counterintuitive, so un-American too. We used to be a meritocracy. That is, you earned your position, you earned what you were. You climbed a ladder by doing well, by meriting each rung, right? So this idea of not choosing according to merit or demerit is so counterintuitive. We don't choose the son who lies to go to the movies on Saturday. We choose the one who tells the truth. We don't reward the employee who's known as a slacker with a year-end bonus, but the one who far exceeds his quota. We don't reward the kid who couldn't finish the race with a participation certificate, but rather we give the first place finisher a trophy. Wait a minute. We do reward with participation. Forget that one. We used to reward with a first place trophy, didn't we? But all in all, in human thinking, merit in human relations is the basis for reward and punishment, for favor or disfavor, for love or hatred, for that matter. It just doesn't seem fair to choose in any other fashion. So we bring this to the table when we think about God. We think horizontally, not vertically. God encourages us to think vertically when we come to this issue. Because we are not speaking of human relations strictly. We are speaking of the purposes of God. Whether He chooses to reveal those purposes to us or not. There was a reason God's choice was determined before they were born and had done nothing good or bad. We see this indicated in the purpose clause that follows. In order that. What was the purpose? In order that God might look down the corridor of time and foresee the good or the bad that the boys do. No. That is indeed a common way out, but there's no hint of this here, is there? There's no hint that God is looking down the corridor of time as a basis for merit, right? To see whether the kids are going to do. And then He makes His decision to elect or choose. In order that God might foresee what the nations the boys will come to represent will do, whether it's good or bad. And this has at least the virtue, to the Arminian mind anyway, of saving free will for the individual believer to choose. Though once again, there's not a scintilla of evidence for this here in the text. We're speaking of individuals from beginning to end. So these in order that options that many try and take, once again, bring us to that theological twister we were talking about. You know, what this text really means is this, but then that gives me difficulties over here and what that one really means, and pretty soon you're in a pretzel knot, aren't you, trying to explain texts that are clear on their face. Because these efforts at theological twister fail on both counts by what follows, that is, that God's purpose of election might continue. That God's purpose of election might continue. It began with Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac, and now continues. His purpose of election continues to stand with Jacob and Esau. It is God's purpose of election that forms the basis for choosing Jacob over Esau. It is God's purpose of election that stands for choosing Jacob over Esau. Okay then, Mr. Smarty Pants Pastor, what is that purpose, huh? I'm an Arminian, believing in free will. There's got to be free will somewhere, doesn't there? Let me see here, right? I just feel it's got to be right. This doesn't seem right that I don't choose. What is that purpose then, Mr. Pastor? We've been sitting here breathlessly waiting to find out exactly why God chose Jacob over Esau. Why then, pray tell, did God do it in this way? Are you ready? He doesn't tell us. Does he? He doesn't tell us. Huh? It just gets more frustrating for the free will Arminian, doesn't it? Not only does God not choose according to my expectations, that is human merit, but then he has the effrontery to leave unrevealed his real purpose for choosing one over the other. How deeply unsatisfying, isn't it? How deeply unsatisfying from a prying, free will, human perspective. God, inquiring minds want to know. You heard that before? Inquiring minds want to know. This clever pitch has sold millions of copies of the National Enquirer, but it hasn't budged God from keeping the secret counsel of his own will, has it? Because that indeed is where his purpose in election resides. And we must learn then to be satisfied with what God has revealed to us. But Pastor, that just doesn't seem fair, does it? That's un-American. Doesn't seem fair. And if it's true, it makes us robots, doesn't it? Well, Paul anticipates these things, and just coincidentally, he begins to answer both of those questions then in subsequent verses, and we'll look at those then in subsequent weeks. But until then, Paul underlines by reiteration, he says, not because of works, but because of him who calls, right? As you see in your text, not because of works, but because of him who calls. He's picking up on what he has just said previously, that indeed, before they had done anything good or bad, right, by works. He says here as a kind of an inclusio, as a kind of a other side of the envelope to include this here, because not because of works then, but because of him who calls. Where have we heard that before? Not because of works. Well, of course, we've heard that in Paul's exposition of justification, right? No one will be justified by works of the law, but through faith in Jesus Christ. That's grace, isn't it? We are saved by grace through faith, not by works, lest anyone should boast, right? That's grace, isn't it? Why shouldn't election not also be by grace? Not by human choice, human will, human merit, human works. It's consistent with grace, isn't it? The doctrines of grace. That's why we call the doctrine of God's sovereignty one of the doctrines of grace. What a blessing it is, too. I love the doctrines of grace. I have come to love the doctrines of grace. This is precisely why we call this election now, the sovereignty of God, absolute election. Doctrines of grace, because we are chosen by grace, God's grace. Well, then Paul then seals his argument with text that they would all know too. Let's look at verse 12 and 13. Absolute election. The utter sovereignty of God in election is observed in God's will to love one and hate the other. God's will to love one and hate the other. I didn't think God hated anybody. Because God, you know, you'll hear that in many a church. God doesn't hate anybody. John Murray puts it this way. He says, the hate of God must be considered in the exalted, transcendent nature of God and not from a human perspective. Once again, we must decouple our thinking about God and His nature and begin to think in biblical terms. Oprah Winfrey rejected Christianity when she heard a preacher talk about God as jealous. She said, "I don't want to worship a God who has jealousy." And of course, what's she thinking? She's thinking horizontally. She is not thinking in terms of Scripture and the exalted, transcendent nature of God. God is a jealous God, and God as well hates. But not in the way you and I hate. Not in the way you and I are jealous. The utter sovereignty of God in election is observed in God's will to love one and hate the other. These texts are twofold. The older will serve the younger, from Genesis 25 and verse 23. This was the explicit temporal outworking then of God's purpose of election in redemptive history. God reveals His choice then to love one and hate the other. He reveals that choice to Rebekah and Isaac before they were born and had done anything good or bad, so that they would know that this is the sovereign purpose of God. There'd be no oops on God's part, right? No oops. I never intended this reversal of fortunes with Esau having his birthright usurped and his blessing stolen, but I'll make lemonade from these lemons and go with plan B. No, God reveals from the outset His intent to have the older serve the younger, to make it utterly clear that it is His purpose in election that stands. And then He concludes with His second barrel, if you will. Jacob I love, but Esau I hate it. From Malachi 1. Paul quotes God's defense of His love for Israel by showing just how a reversal of fortunes reveals God's electing love. Jacob, who was the younger and should have served the elder with the birthright and the blessing, right? But he absconded with him instead. He says, "Jacob I loved, but Esau, who should have been served by the younger in these things, but Esau I hated." This is a perfect example of God's absolute election. Because all through the Genesis narrative, we do not obtain a hint as to God's reasons for choosing Jacob, other than we see Him doing so. Choosing Jacob, He does. In fact, from a purely human perspective, I kind of like Esau better than Jacob. There's every reason to prefer the rugged, manly Esau over the camp-dwelling mama's boy, Jacob, right? But God chooses to love the one and hate the other. And brothers and sisters, as it is with Jacob and Esau, so it is with us. Paul is going to begin to bring all this home, too, in weeks to come, that this applies to you and to me, as well as to Jacob and Esau. This is how God works. Does that scare you a little bit? It probably should. It sure did me at first when these things started to dawn on me. Wait a minute. The God that I'm seeing here in the text is not the God that I saw in my Sunday school flannel graphs. It's not the God that I was introduced to. God loves you and has a marvelous plan for your life. Well, looking at this text, maybe He doesn't. Because that depends on God's sovereign will, His electing will, not on my choice, not on my so-called free will. We have already seen, Paul has already established, that we do not have a free will in the sense that most of us think we have free wills. That is unrestricted choice, unaffected by anything God or anyone else does. As it is with Jacob and Esau, so it is with us. If grace indeed is at work in your heart and mind, if you know the living Christ, it is because God has so elected that you would. So chosen you, such that you would. I know. If you're new to this, tendency is to stubbornly reject it for what it is and say, well, there's other places that talk about the free will of man too, right? Right? Right, please? Once again, I invite you to bring them to me. Besides my friend Will, who I spent many an hour hiking and talking about these things with and going through scriptures. I remember holding that piece of notebook paper in my hand as I'm hiking. We're going through these texts. And I also had another friend who came to love and appreciate the doctrines of grace. That is the truth and reality of the utter sovereignty of God in election. The absolute election of God in your salvation. But before he did, he had a crisis moment. When on the night he came to understand in a Bible study that this indeed is what the text was saying, he became so infuriated that he took his Bible and threw it in the corner, saying, if that's what God is like, I don't want anything to do with him. I appreciated a couple of things about that incident. At least he was honest with the text, right? He understood that that is what the text was saying, and he didn't try to play Jimmy games with the text and say, oh, what it really means, or what's in the background here. So he was honest with the text, and he was honest with his feelings, too. I felt the same way. I just didn't have the nerve to throw my Bible in a corner. They're natural. They're natural feelings. Because we're wired for, in our lost and fallen nature, indeed, to think that we are under the illusion. We're under the illusion that we are indeed free, you know, to choose without restriction, without impact from any other source, right? But there is no wiggle room here. There is no wiggle room. Paul does not give us the luxury of wiggle room. And you'll go on then in subsequent verses too. There's no way out. There are no verses that talk of free will that counterbalance these, that speak of God's sovereignty. They just aren't there. Believe me, I've looked. As I've gone through text and read the Bible again and again, I haven't found them yet. Maybe you have. Bring them to me. If you know and love grace, because that is what this is, bottom line, is all about. If you know and love grace, know and love the doctrines of grace. And you'll come to know and love this sovereign, powerful, transcendent, mysterious God as well. All the more, you'll come to love him all the more for these doctrines of grace. And you'll come to love his Son as well, chosen from before the foundation of the world, as Peter says, to die for you and bring you close to this God as well, for whom there should always be that little trembling of fear, right, and awe, because he is a fearsome and awesome God. We'll begin to unpack the reasons, some of the other reasons for this fear and awe for this God, but who also loves immeasurably too. He's loved you immeasurably in giving you Christ and bringing you to himself. Let us now come to that place where we see the electing love of God, and we do see the electing love of God reprised for us in the body and blood of the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.